Du lytter til Radio 24/7,
den originale taleradio.
Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjærulf.
Velkommen til et program, der er iført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, og i den her specialudgave af Aflyttet, ja, så bliver vi så at sige indeni. Hele programmet handler nemlig om en samtale med en mand, der måske slet ikke er den, han siger, han er, eller også så er han, og så er han alligevel noget helt andet, og han på sin side, han kan jo heller ikke være helt sikker på, hvem jeg er og hvad jeg er for en, men alligevel så endte vi faktisk med at tale sammen i telefonen i 50 minutter. Jeg ved en lille smule om, hvem manden burde være. Han burde være Mark Farid, kunstner fra England, der i den grad bruger sit liv på at lege skæg og blå briller med sig selv og sin omverden. Historien om ham og det, han har gjort, er en historie om den måde, vi alle sammen sejler rundt i hinandens billeder på. Og når jeg skal fortælle den, og det skal jeg om et lille øjeblik, ja, så begynder jeg bagfra, hvor jeg efter 45 minutter samtale fik lyst til at vide, hvordan der egentlig så ud der på det sted, jeg har ringet til, og hvor han er.
I could tell you anything and you would believe me. Okay, I'll tell you the truth. So right now I'm sitting in my bedroom because I wanted to relax a bit today myself. There's a work to do, so I was going to work from home in my bed. I have a signed Leicester shirt because I'm a giant Leicester fan because I'm from Leicester. I've got two Leicester shirts, one's downstairs though. Signed of the winning season last year, and then the other one from 97 when I was a boy and I got it signed. Yeah, I've got a computer, got another computer. I've got like loads of phones and stuff. But I only use one of those phones and one of those laptops for this one. It's alright, I'm quite high up. We're on the third floor in a block of flats. Third and fourth floor. It's nice. There's like a little grass area bit where people can play, where we go and play football sometimes. And on the other side, you can see the left topmost upper chimney of Tate's, of Battersea Power Station. See, now any keen person now knows actually where I live. Do you see what I did there? Do you see what you made me do? Because if you now go and poise this antidote website, you can see on a map where I am. And I've just described to you kind of my views from my windows. So now you can actually start identifying which flat is mine.
So we know how to drone bomb you.
Yeah, and you know when I'm not at home, so you can rob me if you want to rob me.
Mark Farid beskriver sit rum. Der er en seng, nogle computer, nogle telefoner og en udsigt. Udsigten, gør han opmærksom på, er egentlig ikke noget særligt. Men alle de oplysninger, han er kommet til at give mig, betyder faktisk, at man vil kunne finde ud af præcis, hvor han bor, bare ved hjælp af Google og Google Maps. Ud fra det, han beskriver, han kan se fra sit vindue, der kan nemlig google mig frem til selve bygningen. Og med de informationer vil jeg kunne overvåge ham, finde ud af, om han er hjemme, og så røve hans lejlighed. Eller sende en drone efter ham, foreslår jeg. Ja, også det, siger Mark Farid, der ellers ikke er ukendt med det at miste sig selv.
When I gave her my passwords in October 2015, I gave her my passwords and I gave her my online banking passwords as much as anything else. And they were closed, my online banking details. I changed banks. But still, so that was in October. In February, really, when stuff was getting particularly hard, that was actually a thing that helped me a little bit get better. Was that someone committed identity theft against me.
Sidste år valgte han at opgive sin egen identitet. Han lagde koder og adgangsnavne til alle sine konti på sociale medier og netbanker og alle andre steder offentligt ud, og så levede han som end 6 måneder under jorden uden nogen form for internetadgang, og det skal vi høre mere om senere. Men først så skal vi tale lidt om, hvad der egentlig skete, da nogen stjal hans identitet, mens han selv levede uden nogen form for internetadgang.
And they made a brand new bank account at a bank that I'd never been with, and they made a credit card and then started buying stuff. And then one day I just started getting letters telling me, do I want to get insurance for my brand new giant TV that I just bought, or my brand new iPhone, whatever it was at the time, or my brand new MacBook and that and whatever. And I let it carry on for a little bit, actually, just to see what would happen, and then stopped it all. And then I tried to find the person, and I was able to find... They know that he bought the phone from 106 High Street, Kensington, Vodafone. So then I went there and got the CCTV footage of the person. And, you know, it wasn't hard to do this stuff. And I'd be speaking to the bank and saying, you know, how is this so feasible to do? How is this so possible? And I was recording all of this. So all of this is documented. I haven't put it together. But I've got it all. And that bank were telling me that this is a very common occurrence. This never happens. This never happens. When I speak to the police, they tell me that 9 out of 10 conversations that they have on this phone is to do with exactly this. So then I go back to the bank and I'm like, yo, so the police actually tell me that you do this this happens 9 out of 10 times. You tell me this never happens. Look, listen to the recording, play it to them. And they're like, okay, yeah, you've got to understand that this or whatever. And then eventually we get down to the conversation. I'm like, so how, because I didn't tell them, of course, that I gave my passwords to my digital life, because that would be stupid to tell them that. They never asked. So I asked them, how does this happen? And how can I go and commit identity theft against someone else, essentially? To which they walked me through the online procedures. Then I start doing the online procedure. And the reality is to make a brand new bank account with a very reputable bank in the UK that you have never had a bank account with online, all you need is someone's name, date of birth, and address. Those three bits of information are enough to get a legitimate, real debit and credit card from a bank. That's where I'm broadcasting all of my digital life and giving you access to everything. Actually, the reality is you need my name, date of birth, and address. So then when the police would ask me for my name, date of birth, and address, I'd point out the irony in that that's enough to commit identity theft against me, to which they would just get a bit angry and not see the funny side of that. But yeah, even the smallest bits of data, even the, you know, odds are on that it wouldn't be hard to work out someone's password. You probably have about 3 passwords that you sift through, depending on different security stuff. And those passwords, you know, are linked to you in some ways. The city that you grew up in, it's the name of your favorite band. It's like there are, given enough time, you work it out. And once you got the password to something, you've suddenly got the account. In the same way that we started this conversation, you said, how do I know that this is the real Mark Farrod? How do you know that you're talking to the real Mark Farrod on Facebook? How do you ever know that Mark Farrod is actually taking the money out of the bank account? This is one of the things where I'm actually quite concerned about using the fingerprint thing on iPhones and phones now, is that that's the first time that actually you can now start saying that was actually Mark Farrod who went onto the phone at that time.
And you can also see a future where your fingerprint will be for sale somewhere in some sort of digital stage.
Yeah, but that I put that responsibility on you. Who has your fingerprint in the world? Probably no one, except for very small percentage of people, kind of police-esque things. But the reality is people don't actually have your fingerprint. Now you're choosing to give up your fingerprint very voluntarily to companies who have been very clearly proven to not keep your data safe. That on that side, I put the responsibility on the individual. If your fingerprint is being sold, that's on you. I think you've given enough warning about this kind of stuff.
Det med fingeraftryk som godkendelse på telefoner, er det nu en god idé? Mark Farrod er ikke overbevist, men sikker på, at det bliver fremtiden, hvis man skal bevise, hvem man er. Og det har han faktisk selv været nødt til at gøre rigtig mange gange. Dengang, for eksempel for et år siden i oktober 2015, hvor Mark Farrod gjorde noget yderst radikalt, nemlig gav alle sine koder væk, lagde dem på internettet og prøvede i 6 måneder at leve uden for den digitale matrix, der fandt matrixen ham meget hurtigt. Identitetstyve, de brugte hans informationer til at købe store TV'er og iPhones og computer og den slags med. Mark opdagede det, da der begyndte at komme fysiske breve til hans lejlighed fra forsikringsselskaberne, der alle sammen tilbydede forsikringer til de fine nye ting, han havde købt, og Mark lod det faktisk køre et stykke tid, før han gik til politiet. Med sig havde han overvågningskamera billeder fra de butikker, som identitetstyvene havde købt ting i hans navn, og alle samtalerne havde haft med medarbejderne der. Han spurgte politiet, hvordan det her egentlig kunne lade sig gøre, og fik at vide, at det var forbavsende let, og at 3 ud af 4 henvendelser, de fik i de her dage, faktisk handlede om den her slags identitetstyveri. Politiet sagde også, at man kun behøver 3 styks informationer for at kunne lave et kreditkort online. Navn, adresse og fødselsdato. Så nemt er det, sagde de til Mark. Mark spurgte dem, om de ikke kunne se det ironiske i, at det var præcis det samme, politiet altid bad om, men det synes de ikke var særlig morsomt. Mark optager alting. Også samtalerne med politiet og med de butikker, identitetstyvene havde benyttet, og dem fik han faktisk brug for, da han skulle overbevise banken om, at det ikke var ham, der havde købt alle de her ting. Han undlod dog at fortælle sin bank én ting, at han selv havde lagt sine kontooplysninger ud på nettet, og at han generelt lægger alting ud. Og hermed er vi tilbage ved den rigtige begyndelse, hvor jeg er nødt til at stille Mark Farid et centralt spørgsmål. Hvordan kan jeg egentlig være sikker på, at det er ham, jeg taler med?
It's a good question. You're just gonna have to trust that you are. It's in the same way as, you know, if you go to a bank and you enter your PIN code, the bank assumes that's you just because you've entered 4 numbers. I think the internet's kind of the same, isn't it? In the sense of you just have to trust.
So we have to trust. We have to trust each other. But that's okay. The subject of a major part of your works is surveillance in one form or the other. Why do you find that very interesting, and how did you get into this kind of subject area?
Well, I find that I'm more interested in kind of individual autonomy and what makes me, what powers do I have, what allows me to be individual. Or the illusion of this is actually what I'm more interested in. And data privacy very quickly comes into that, and surveillance in terms of control and conformity, because that's where individuality kind of isn't allowed to exist. So that's why I care about it in a very small answer. But it's to do with the power, and it's to do with the real potential of what you can do with surveillance. And that's basically, it's a hard question.
Well, one of the things I've been having this as a subject of discussion and been doing work about surveillance for a long time, one of the things the feelings I have currently is that we are kind of, the people who are against surveillance are kind of losing currently. How do you feel about it?
I think it's a lost battle, is actually how I think it goes. I think that public opinion is very clear. In terms of democracy, democracy has spoken. People quite clearly don't want privacy. In terms of it being a lost battle, it is being a lost battle, but I think it's a battle that we still have to keep on fighting, because it's a battle that once it's lost, it's lost. And I think privacy is one of those things that only once it's gone do we realise actually how valuable and important it was. But yeah, it is totally a lost battle. And I think we all know this. And in the UK, for example, the Investor Powers Bill, yeah, that's going through by, nearly 400 votes, that it couldn't be clearer. And that's just to legalise everything that the NSA and GCHQ and BND and whoever else are doing. But yeah, and it isn't fun. And it's not fun when you turn into a hermit and society's options don't give you real options. And I think that that's where it's failing, really, in capitalism. Capitalism promises choice. And if we're going to live in a capitalist world, we have to have choice. That's the only thing that capitalism can succeed in. And there is no choice over the use of services. And that's the real problem, I think.
Vi bliver nok nødt til bare at stole på hinanden, siger han, der altså kalder sig for Mark Farid. Ham, der kalder sig for Mark Farid, interesserer sig rigtig meget for overvågning. Men ligesom jeg, så oplever han, at det går tilbage med kampen mod overvågningssamfundet. Det er en tabt kamp egentlig, siger han. I England der har man lige vedtaget det såkaldte Snoopers Charter, en lov, der får Søren Pinds yderst standhaftige idé om sessionslokning til at blegne. Snoopers Charter giver regeringen adgang til al kommunikation og kræver, at der skal være bagdør i alt software, som borgerne bruger, og dommerkendelser, det bruger vi simpelthen ikke mere. Som Mark Farid siger, så har man simpelthen legaliseret alt det, som NSA og den engelske søsterorganisation GCHQ, Government Communication Headquarters, hidtil har gjort ulovligt. Og i sidste ende, så mener Mark, så er det døden for vores kapitalistiske system. Den slags kræver nemlig frie valg, og dem har vi simpelthen ikke mere. Og nu skal vi tale om bøger. Mark har nemlig tre, han holder mere af end nogen andre. Det er 1984 af George Orwell, Fagre nye verden af Aldous Huxley og så Dave Eggers The Circle. Men hvilken af de tre beskriver vores verden bedst lige nu?
Well, Brave New World, I think. But I think The Circle. I think The Circle is one of the greatest books I've ever read, personally, in terms of it persuading people in such a short way into why this is such an important area. But I think it's Brave New World. I think it's The Circle. I think it's We Live in Public. I think it's 1984. I think it's Big Brother. I think it's many, many, many dystopian worlds that we all know. And I don't necessarily think a dystopian world is bad. I think with every dystopia, there's a utopia, or whatever Margaret Atwood said, for every little utopia. I don't know what other saying is. I think the lack of autonomy could be a good thing. I think the illusion of autonomy could be the dream if it's used in the right way. But it isn't, and it quite clearly isn't used in the right way. So it's not a good thing. But I think one question I'm quite interested by that I want to ask you is what do you think the advantages are to total surveillance?
I think there are a lot of the main advantage makes people feel secure, and there's an advantage that if I'm being totally surveilled, then nobody, if it's done properly, then it might work to my advantage if somebody wants to put something to say I have done something which I haven't. That's the only advantage I can think about.
What about in terms of efficiency for how quick we could make everything so we know everything about everyone's life? In terms of do you not think conformity to one ideology for a huge group of people is not a great thing?
Yeah.
That's peace, that's harmony, that's order, that's everything that we kind of wanted to structure the world in a way. I think that conversation needs to be had, because I think the conversation's gone the wrong way. I think that people have to justify the need for privacy. No, I think it's that you have to justify the invasion into privacy. And I think the argument's been flipped in a very clever way, where it should never have to be that you defend yourself. Like, one of my biggest issues is with the phrase, I have nothing to hide. And that phrase is so brilliant because everyone uses it in the world. Maybe that's why it's a Brave New World, because I don't believe that every single person in the world individually made up that saying, I have nothing to hide, and then chants it on their mantra together alone. It is Brave New World, I think. But the brilliancy of the phrase, I have nothing to hide, is that it puts you on the defensive. It suggests that you're guilty until you're proven innocent. And in the 21st century, that isn't how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be that you're innocent until proven guilty. And you should never have to defend your innocence. And that's why I think the biggest flaw in the whole argument has gone, is that we've been made to feel guilty. That wasn't your question, though, was it?
Mark Farid vender et spørgsmål mod mig i stedet. Hvad synes jeg er fordelen, eller hvad kunne være fordelene ved total overvågning? Og det eneste, jeg kan komme i tanke om, er, at jeg måske kunne bruge det imod dem, der overvåger mig, til rent faktisk at bevise, hvor jeg har været, hvis nogen prøver at sætte mig i en fælde. Mark har det meget svært med et begreb. Begrebet, jeg har ikke noget at skjule. Problemet med, jeg har ikke noget at skjule, er, at man kommer i defensiven. At man skal forklare sig for at bevise, at man ikke er skyldig. Vi er alle sammen kommet til at føle os skyldige. Og det er ikke sådan, det skal være, siger Mark. Mark har selv leget med problemet omkring det, ikke at have noget at skjule, da han lavede et værk i 2011, der hedder Positive Law. Her ser man Mark på et grynet overvågningsvideokamerabillede. Mark taler med en politibetjent. Mark havde nemlig formastet sig til at notere placeringer af overvågningskameraer i London ned på en blok. Og det tiltrak politiets opmærksomhed.
Hey, excuse me, can I ask what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm just noting down where the CCTVs are. We're moving to Westminster where we are now.
Why?
I plan to compare where they noted down, where the ones that I'm noting down are in response to looking at Westminster Council's website because they show you where the registered ones are.
But why?
I'm just interested in knowing, really.
So you've got a lot of work without having a reason for it.
Yeah, no, I'm just interested in knowing where the CCTVs are watching me from.
I've just seen, I saw one of your videos on your website. It's called Positive Law. It's an older video, but what is going on there?
Positive Law. I haven't watched that video in a very, very long time until I watched it yesterday, in fact. Positive Law. It was inspired, I don't think it's actually said on the video, it was inspired by this woman called Manu Lakhu, I can't pronounce her last name. I saw her once when I was in foundation at school. This was my first ever art project at university. And I don't believe that she did what she was claiming to do, so I went and tried to do it myself. And which was that, where I was walking around Parliament. She didn't do it in Parliament. Walking around Parliament and getting police to stop and search for me. So I was walking around Parliament, writing down where the CCTVs weren't. And two policemen very quickly came and stopped me, especially being of both of my parents are Egyptian, so they're Arabic, so I have a certain look to me. So when I'm outside Parliament writing down where CCTVs are on a map, you know, very quickly you get stopped. So two policemen came up to me and were like, what are you doing? And I was saying that it's my right to. And it was for me, this was the beginning of kind of switching roles and playing with control. Because they're obviously in control of the situation. But then a minute or 2 minutes in, I get a piece of paper telling them that it's against human rights to stop and search me. And then rules change, but they still don't call me out on having pieces of paper which tell them the law, which I found very interesting. That at that point, the dynamic should have shifted. But it never did. That they still remained autonomous despite them listening to what I was telling them that they could do to me. And the video, it actually went on for much longer. It went on for about 11 minutes, where they do try to arrest me at one point. Then I tell them that they can't do this for various other laws, and they listen, which is the craziest bit, that when I give them a piece of paper, which have laws which aren't truthful, that don't hold up, that they listen to me at the time a 19-year-old boy. And I was very, very interested. So then I got the CCTV footage from Westminster Council, and I was recording the whole conversation, so I just put the two together. But yeah, it was very, very much so inspired by Manu.
Okay, that's fine. Let me have a look in your bag.
Sorry, what?
Can I have your bag to look in?
You're not surely allowed to do this, are you?
Yes. Yeah, trust me. I'm allowed to stop you, I'm allowed to have a look in your bag.
And what's this little thing?
Prevention of terrorism act, okay?
The stop and search, you know?
That was part of the law, yeah,
last year it was made legal.
Oprindeligt ønskede Mark Frit at gentage et eksperiment, han havde set i en film i skolen, hvor en filmskaber stillede sig op foran overvågningskamera rundt omkring i London, og så med loven i hånden krævede de optagelser, hun selv var på, udleveret. Bagefter klippede hun det hele sammen til en film, som Mark så, men ikke troede på, kunne være virkelig. Han ville gentage forsøget og rød derfor i klins med politiet, der undrede sig over, hvad han lavede. Politiet prøvede faktisk at anholde Mark, der dengang var 19 år gammel, men fordi han havde printet lovene ud for, hvad de kunne tilbageholde ham for, så lod de faktisk være. Og det er paradoksalt, siger han, at bare fordi man har et stykke papir, så vil myndighederne gerne høre på en og respektere en. Men det var kun begyndelsen på Marks lejen med overvågningsstaten. Sidste år, i oktober, begyndte han på et ekstremt eksperiment med sig selv i hovedrollen. Det begyndte med en installation af to containere, som besøgende kunne gå igennem. De blev bedt om at skrive under på, at Mark måtte gå ind i deres telefoner og deres data, og i container nummer to, der kunne de se alle de her data visualiseret meget konkret, og det kunne folk ikke lide. Så Mark tog konsekvensen og satte sig selv i spil. Han opgav alle sine passwords og alle sine konti og levede uden i 6 måneder. og bagefter så vendte han det hele på hovedet. Nu sender han alt.
So Date Shadow was in October of 2015, and it was a big blue shipping. It was inside of a big blue shipping container in central Cambridge. So the old kind of cobbled streets, like opposite two universities, kind of very, very stereotypical Cambridge, old, beautiful English kind of thing. And then there's this big blue shipping container in the center of the area. And you go in and it's individual experience one at a time. And you're first presented, so split by 4 meters and 4 meters inside the container. When you first enter, you're first presented with a woman standing there to ask you to sign a contract. And if you ask her any questions, she'll just stare at you dead in the eye, kind of like terms and conditions do. And then once you sign the contract eventually, which no one ever read it, not one person, and it told you very explicitly that we were going to take the contents of your phone, you then join our Wi-Fi via a captive portal, and then we take all of the data. And then 36 seconds later, you go into the second half after the door opens automatically. And then as you walk through, we're tracking your physical shape using an Xbox Kinect, and projected onto either side of the wall, moving with you in real time on both sides, is your moving image. Inside of one of you, the last 1,000 characters of your most recent text messages, and on the other side, 64 images that you've taken on your phone that we've stitched together. So as you move around from left to right, you reveal more of one image and less of another. So you kind of become your data in its literal sense. And people got really angry, and other people were fine, and we were finding nudes, and we were finding whatever, and I was amazed at the mixed response. Obviously people got it, and people were, how dare you? But ultimately, people didn't care. Most of the people were all right with their data being looked at in that kind of way, because it seemed fairly controlled. So I then gave away my passwords to my entire digital life to do with the same exhibition at a talk titled Anonymity is Our Only Right, and That's Why It Must Be Destroyed. And, you know, that was then where I learned that we don't have a choice over these things. And maybe that's why, and it was very horrible and distressing and lonely and, you know, really not a fun 6 months for me. But maybe that's why people are right. And I think that we can be cleverer with how we take on this thing, because people don't want privacy. Fine, people don't want privacy. But at least that's coming from an informed position. It's about where that opinion is coming from. Because I don't believe that anyone who doesn't want privacy or anyone who carries on with stuff how it is making an informed decision. But my problem is, and I was saying this yesterday, in fact, at a talk, that I think, as I say, I think the question's been put in the wrong way. I think the argument's been put on the wrong people. But I also think our way of approaching it is wrong, mine included. That I think that the structure of the 21st century, the way of the internet, the empowerment that it can give you, the feeling of empowerment, the illusion of a voice, are all quite dangerous things. And I think that it's, and you know, when we care about something, we'll go and sign a petition now online, we'll click it, and then we'll go away, and we'll feel like we've done something. Or we'll post something on Facebook, and we'll put a big rant, and then that's it, and we'll get 20 comments, maybe. And 20's a lot, so we'll be like, that's great. Or even when we care a bit more, we'll go and protest in the real world. But in the UK, anyway, you've got to apply to the police, get 6 days' listen permission from them first. They'll allow you to tell you the route that you can go in, which is very ordered and very controlled by the police, telling you the exact time frame that you can be there. And then you go home, and then you've done your part. And I think that's the common thing there is, you know, you have this little out, and then you've done your part. That I think we can be clever with. One route that I'm thinking is that we organise a day where we don't use Facebook. One day where we don't use Facebook, everyone communally. Let's see what life is like without Facebook. You know, no one really likes Facebook. Everyone complains about having it. So let's try what it is like for one day. Let's see how different our news sources are. Really, let's see how affected we are in the world. And actually, for one day, and the amount that would lose Facebook and targeted advertising revenue, then they have to look at, see, then they notice something. And the day that I would want it to be is the 1st of October, maybe next year, because that's Facebook's birthday in the UK. And in doing that, people literally have to do nothing. It's not the best idea, but it's an idea. And I think there are different paths to go. Again, that wasn't a question at all, was it?
No, but it's still very interesting answers to whatever it was. So, and I like the 1st of October as the new Don't Use Facebook Day. That's a very good idea. I think I'll try to promote it in Denmark too.
Please do.
Mark har fået en idé. En dag om året skal vi lade være med at bruge Facebook. Bare en dag. Det burde være nok til at forvirre deres algoritmer, og tilstrækkeligt til, at vi begyndte at tænke over, hvordan vi kunne leve uden Facebook. Det burde være den 1. oktober, for det er Facebooks fødselsdag, mener han. Men hvordan var det egentlig, dengang han levede uden adgang til nettet, her i de første 2 uger i København?
Well, it was actually in Copenhagen for my first 2 weeks of it. For the first 2 weeks, I didn't have a mobile phone or laptop. And then after that, it became very, very apparent almost immediately that for me to have any potential to work, for me to have any potential to have an income, for me to have a life, to be able to live, I needed to have a phone and laptop. So that was really the first thing, that we don't have a choice. And even those laptops, so I had 3 different laptops, which I used only in very, very specific locations at very specific times. And I'd be scrambling my IP address to say that I was in a different location, as well as being in a different location, as well as using so many different things, that firewalls, but in terms of physical firewalls as much as kind of digital firewalls. So many safeguards, so many whatever you want to call it, that I didn't really have computers, but I had access to computers and, you know, I could search stuff. And that was my real issue is, yeah, some bits of it were really great. I know myself better without a shadow of a doubt. I know what I want in life. I know who my friends are in reality. That my friends, yeah, although they became very, very small in terms of amount of people very, very quickly. Even in terms of having a phone, I had a different phone every month and different SIM cards, and I would only give my phone number to very, very, very select people. And I wouldn't give you, if I gave you my number 1 month, I wouldn't give it to you another month, because that's a good link to track you from there. There were some positives, and that shouldn't be underestimated, but as a whole, it was horrible. It was so isolating. And really, when you're alone, you know that you're alone. And everyone else has all these things, and it's the everyone else having all of these things that makes it not a choice, because of the cultural isolation that you're then forced into, that you become this void in society, just slowly, just ever so slowly, each day just slipping away, but without you realizing. And then it does get too much, and it does build up, and I think it was around late February where it really, really, really got too much for me. And I did think multiple times about whether to stop doing it, but I carried on. I didn't complain to people because it's my own enforced and rules. So, like, you know, that was also partly what became hard, because you don't want to say to people, as soon as you say to people you don't have Facebook, or as soon as you say to people that you don't even have a smartphone, people see that. It's kind of like being a vegetarian, that people have decided that they don't like that, and that they have this opinion that you feel in some way superior because you're saying no, when that isn't at all the attitude. But it gets into this, it's even that in its own right can be difficult. So when I came back to technology 6 months later, the end of April, it was such a great day. And it was like I was having a hit of whatever, heroin or whatever, for the first time after 6 months, and it was great. And even now, broadcasting my life, coming to the end of broadcasting my life, kind of going from one extreme to the other, I cannot wait to end broadcasting my life. So it's kind of flipped the other way. But yeah.
So what you're doing now is currently taking, we've had some email conversations, yeah, before this interview, all of this stuff, all kind of contacts you have online goes on the web, so you're kind of reversing it. You're doing, what can you call it, self-surveillance in many ways, and broadcasting.
Yeah, completely. So I'm broadcasting everything from my emails, text messages, phone calls, locations, searches, Skype, this phone call, everything. And at first it was great. Then I got quite arrogant. Then I got... Should I be describing this to you, by the way?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So then I got quite arrogant. So when I started the project, the thing that people don't... So I'm broadcasting my entire digital life. Frank was text messages, emails, so sorry. Wait, what was I going to say?
You've got to describe the project.
Okay, yeah, I was going to describe it to you, and then I was going to say something else. So, so broadcasting all of my digital life online. And for the first 15 days of it, I didn't have social media, because I didn't have social media for the prior 11 months. And I was fine as a whole. I, in fact, quite enjoyed it a little bit. I would use it to, especially not having had Facebook for 11 months. Then when I came back onto it, people would then start talking to me who I haven't spoken to in ages. So there's this real kind of, this is kind of me getting Facebook almost for the first time, just running a Facebook account. So there was that kind of element to it, and something that I really missed and kind of enjoyed, and talking to friends that I haven't spoken to since I was 8, and, you know, really nice kind of ways of what it's exactly for. And it's great at that. And, you know, then I would say stuff to people that I wouldn't necessarily say, because I'm now given this platform where I'm broadcasting my life. And, you know, everyone wants that little 15 minutes of fame, even if they don't admit to it. And especially with the way that we've done the website, and it does anonymize the other person. You are anonymized, so people can't identify you. So there's a bit of a novelty there for people. So I would also use that to talk to people, relatively recently single. So it's then also I use that as a good platform as well. I then sent pictures, which I maybe shouldn't have sent, where I was getting a bit more arrogant in conversations with, they sent pictures back. So that's on the website, for example. It was fun. It was great. It was, you know, for not having anything really, it was then having it all in front of me that I was really enjoying it. And I was enjoying every aspect of technology and what it brings. And I was very aware of what I was doing, but I was all right with it. Because everyone that I know who is looking at that website, I speak to. So it's fine. And then I got social media. 15 days came in, halfway. And that's almost immediately I started using Twitter and Facebook. I became quite anxious about what I'd previously posted, about that said arrogance. What else did I say? Because I know that I was getting arrogant. I know that at times I even wanted to create a bit of drama in case someone that I didn't know was watching. And, you know, I could definitely play it up to it. But then I instantly regret that, because that's only ever going to come back to me, probably, because the internet never forgets. So I searched through it, tried to, like, see actually was it as bad as what I did. I can't delete anything from there. So it's still there, everything. But very quickly I then started watching what I was saying. In fact, conversations tried to be geared towards making me look cooler. I became very apparent very quickly that people that, you know, I was speaking to, friends that I hadn't spoken to since I was 8. I was also friends with people on Facebook that I hadn't seen since I was 8, but not friends with. Or the cool kids in school, or like, you know, that actually you are constantly judging your own actions and what you're doing through who your audience are. And in Facebook specifically, or Twitter or Instagram, you know, your audience actually isn't just one person. It's not even a group of people, because people don't really select just what people can see what. And even so, it's a dangerous territory to get into. That with the internet, you assume that everyone can see everything. And that's the difficult bit. But then even beyond that, so I'm going to give you a slightly more appropriate example. So when I watch adult websites, for example, what's going through my head isn't what everyone thinks. So it kind of is what everyone thinks. But then it's also what would happen if someone that I in the future want a relationship with sees that video that I'm watching now, what would they then think? That I'm even having to speculate on a future partner, which is outrageous. But as a whole, it's good. I found it fun. I'm enjoying myself more. When I'm working, I'm not getting distracted because I know people can see. If you look at the website this morning, you'll see that this is actually the first thing that is actually happening on said website, because I don't want people to know what time I wake up. So I then don't do anything. Well, you'll see there's a Skype call for this, but I then don't do anything until I absolutely have to digitally, which is great. So I'm on the internet less, because I can see my locations. I spend less time at home, so I work from home and live at home. So I tend to go out now every evening to see someone. Great, absolutely fantastic. I'm seeing my family more. Relationships are closer. That how isn't that a better? There are definite better sides to it, and this is why everyone's using it, I think, and why I'm so excited to be using it again. And yeah, I definitely want to see how and what I'll be using it in 3 days. That's the problem. That it is a drug. It's a drug, and we all know it's a drug, and we all choose to ignore the reality that this is a drug. And the longer that we choose to ignore it, the worse it gets, and especially as governments then get some more access to it. The reality is that everything that I was just describing as good then is actually just what society says is good. It's society who says that we should work for 9 hours a day and that we shouldn't get distracted. It's society who says that I should be going out because that's the cool thing to do. You know, it's society's values which are being enforced on me, which, yeah, right now might be a good thing, but it's always about the potential misusage of these things. And in the UK, we have the great phrase of future-proofing laws. And it's such a great buzz trigger word. But what future-proofing actually means is you just make the law more open, and you make it more open to corruption as more open to not corruption. But there's this massive assumption that, first of all, that politicians make the right decisions all the time and will do in every decision in the future. There's the bigger thing of, do we even trust the government right now? And do we trust them with our most personal data, our data? And I think we really need to start realising the true value of our data, and not just in a financial sense, although I do find it incredibly interesting that two of the three most valuable companies in the world provide a free virtual service in Google and Facebook. That really our data is obscenely valuable in its financial sense and its power sense. That we need to start realizing this, and there are ways that we can do it, and not using Facebook for one day is one of many. Yeah.
Mark fandt hurtigt ud af, at han faktisk ikke kunne klare sig uden internetadgang, så han satte i stedet en ære i ikke at sætte fodspor på nettet i det hele taget. Han sørgede kort sagt for, at han ikke kunne spores overhovedet. Han lærte mange ting af det. Han havde pludselig kun en håndfuld venner tilbage og følte sig meget alene. Alle andre var på Facebook, alle andre havde smartphones. Det var det ligesom at være vegetar. Det reagerer folk også meget sært på. Da han så endelig kom tilbage til internettet i april i år, så gik han modsat. Nu sender han hele sit liv ud 24 timer i døgnet. Det glæder han sig også til at holde op, for den her selvovervågning er faktisk svær. Han udsender alle telefonsamtaler, alle mails, sms'er, hvor han befinder sig, og det ændrer, hvordan man faktisk taler med andre. Pludselig skal det hele dramatiseres, og det bliver besværligt, siger Mark Farid. Men hvordan har sådan en som Mark Farid det med en mand som Edward Snowden, ham der vækkede hele verden i 2013, og gjorde det helt klart, at ja, vi lever i et overvågningssamfund?
But I blame, you know, like, do you remember when Snowden's leaks came out in Parliament, not Parliament, the government went to The Guardian and forced them to delete, to destroy their hard drives of information? That is one of the most outrageous things in the history of the world, right? That's in the UK happening. Who have the 38th freest press in the world, just to let you know? The UK had the 34th, so we've gone down last year. We've actually become less free, which is outrageous. Scandinavia tends to be in the top four, kind of with Holland and Netherlands. You're good. That should have been one of the biggest stories in all mainstream media in the UK, that the government isn't letting a newspaper report a story. How is that not the biggest thing to have happened in the UK in the past, however long, in the UK itself? Edward Snowden's obviously a great, great, great man. I think he could, yeah, he he is a great person, but I also think that he needs to be held accountable in a certain way. That he should have known that people in 2013 wouldn't really care about their data being monitored. And really, the only logical, if you think about it, hindsight is a great thing. But if you look back, the reality is that, of course, for example, the UK government, English government, would be using Edward Snowden's leaks in their advantage, actually. And now you see that in 2016, that the Investigatory Powers Bill, which is going through, which becomes a law on the 31st of December of this year, which was being written by our, at the time, Home Secretary and our now unelected Prime Minister, Theresa May. Yeah, Snoopers Charter. You see that Snoopers Charter legalises everything that the National Security Agency and GCHQ and the BND were doing. And by how landslide it's gone through, I actually hold Edward Snowden slightly accountable there, that he burst the illusion of privacy. He told us, not the government, he told us that, look, this horrible thing is going on. Guys, you've got to care about this. And yeah, he was right that we should be caring about this, but you also should know that we wouldn't care. And because he did that, then suddenly the government can go in and legalise everything, get actual permissions to do what they want to do now, legally. And then what's the next step after that? The next step after that is then that people start being held accountable for their data by the government. And that was Edward Snowden's. But, you know, I find that my issue with Snowden, my issue right now, is that I'm really annoyed at the public for how we seem to have got really bored about the argument of data privacy and surveillance. We've all heard the same argument 1,000 times. There's nothing really that anyone can say new anymore, because after the first year of talking about it, you know, you've covered everything. I find that the another strange bit, that we all, you're right, that's a good argument. Everyone kind of agrees with everyone that, yeah, privacy as a whole is this thing that we do need, that goes back to the Magna Carta, that goes back to the Fourth Amendment, the need for a warrant, that even goes back to the European Court of Justice, three months ago, saying that Theresa May is doing is against human rights. And yet, none of us do. We just sit there idly by and can't do anything. And I forgot my point. It was going to be a really good point.
I think you actually made it. But one of the things I was wondering, maybe that could be part of your point, I think, is that the problem is that since we know all this, now we know that this is happening. Before this, it was all tinfoil hats and you're being paranoid and stuff. Now we know what is possible and what is probably being done. And we still continue to live on and do almost the same things we've been doing all the time. And now everybody's saying, oh yeah, that's right, they're spying on us. But as you said in the beginning, we have nothing to hide. But I think that kind of changes us a lot. It also changes the way we are on the internet, because the general idea about being just a citizen walking around like it was like a public square, we can't believe in that anymore.
No, and that's a bad thing. And I don't think we'll ever have that back. And I think maybe the illusion of privacy is better than no privacy at all. The illusion of privacy maybe isn't a bad thing. And that's the other thing. So we've got into this really circular discussion where we all say the same thing, that we're all like, the privacy, like, we can never get it back, it's important as well. But then we're all bored by it. How are we all bored by the discussion? How is that how that discussion goes? That as soon as you say you want to talk about the NSA, half the room will drop. The other half of the room will look more interested, but half the room will drop. And there seems to be this great thing, and I blame the media.
Edward Snowden er et stort menneske, men han er også ansvarlig for noget slemt. Han burde have vidst, at folk i 2013 er totalt ligeglade med at være overvåget. De engelske myndigheder har brugt det mod ham. Nu har de indført regler, der lovliggør alt det, han har afsløret. Snowden burde have vidst, at det var sådan, det ville ende. Nu er vi alle sammen endt et sted, hvor vi skal forsvare vores egne data, og vi er mere hjælpeløse end nogensinde. Nu har vi nemlig ikke engang illusionen om privatliv, og folk keder sig, når man begynder at tale om overvågning.
It's been a very long 28 days, in all honesty. Having been broadcasting live has been very mentally draining, and it's getting quite a lot now. It's the way that I describe it to people is, you know, when you spend a lot of time with people and you just want to go and stare at a screen and be alone. It's exactly like that. But then when I go and stare at the screen, that's when I know that people are watching. That's when I have to start thinking about what I'm doing. And as soon as you start thinking about what you're doing, it becomes incredibly difficult. And my head is just a bit all over the place. That might be my answers are a bit all scattered.
Well, that's good answers. I think maybe we should end it all here, this interview at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I've gotten all the answers I needed, and very nice talking to you.
Yes.
And and I might get back, and then you could turn off the screens for a while and walk somewhere.
Yeah. I come Friday. I'm kind of in a sitcom-esque way. I've even making a list of all the things that I want to say to people. So as soon as the project finishes, I'm going to send like 1,000 messages to everyone.
Mark, gå i stå. Han er træt af det hele. Jeg har det som om, jeg er en levende sitcom, siger han. Det er udmattende. Kender du det, siger han, at man kommer hjem og er dødtræt, og det eneste, man har lyst til, er at sidde og stirre på en skærm. Og når jeg har det sådan, så ved jeg faktisk samtidig, at det lige præcis er der, hvor folk faktisk sidder og stirrer på mig. Det er ikke rart, siger altså Mark Farid. Og måske er det det rigtige sted at slutte den her samtale. Den cirkler lidt, synes jeg. Og jeg kan mærke, at han optager det hele i sin ende, og jeg optager også, og nu må en af os trykke stop.
This is one of the interesting things that this project is highlighting, is by collating all of my digital life into one place, which is just highly efficient, is really what it is. It's, I find it is basically your screen to your smartphone. That is basically my life, because it's your newsfeed, and it's collating it into one place, essentially. And by seeing it all in one place, knowing that other people can see it, but documented in such a way, just archived, essentially, it's made me very clearly see what is digital and what is physical, and that separation between the two. And in some ways, I don't think that I'm necessarily the best person to be using this as a case study from, because, you know, I have spent the last 11 months of my life trying not to use this kind of stuff. And then suddenly coming back into it, being made public, is a very teething phase period for me. I thought multiple times about whether I should extend this. And I would like to, really, but I just don't want to. It's really not fun. And I'm really not enjoying it. And I wasn't enjoying these 6 months either, but I just want to start enjoying myself a bit more. But one thing that it has very clearly highlighted to me, the separation between the physical and the virtual. And even in the conversations that I have with people online, although there's a very surface level conversation-esque, it might appear deeper, but I think that might be all conversations, maybe. This is why I'm not a very good person to judge, I don't think, right now, anyway. But it's made me appreciate the relationships with people, but I always have because of the last 11 months. But it's made me kind of, when I'm with people, I'll tend to talk to them about stuff which I couldn't be saying online. I might be making inappropriate jokes that I maybe shouldn't be saying. Or I'll be just like playing and being a bit silly. Or I'll be having a really serious conversation with you about love and happiness and the meaning of life and how we see the world, whatever. But it's very much so, for me, in some aspects, done it quite well in terms of the separation. But as I say, I'm not a very good person to judge this.
Aflyttet er forbi for i dag. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærulf, og jeg tror nok, jeg har talt med kunstneren Mark Farid, hvis websites vi linker til via aflyttet.dk. Så kan du også høre hans version af den her samtale. Vi vender naturligvis tilbage næste uge med mere nyt for det her overvågningssamfund, som vi alle sammen bor i, her bag skærmene, hvorfra sekunderne danner himmelstiger, som vi kravler op af, kun for at opdage, at alt er lys, og i det kan vi ingenting se. Kun lukke øjnene hårdt i og drømme om sandheden i en sjæl og et legeme. Det bliver ikke lige nu, men måske om lidt.
Du lytter til Radio 24/7. Om lidt er der nyheder.